You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest is Miriam Taves, author of 8 fiction and nonfiction books. Her titles include All My Puny Sorrows and A Complicated Kindness, among others. Her latest novel is called Women Talking and is based on true events in a secluded conservative Mennonite colony in Bolivia, where over 100 women were drugged and raped over a period of 4 years, starting in 2005. In Women Talking, Taves imagines 8 of the Mennonite women holding secret meetings in a barn to discuss what they should do about the violence which has been perpetrated by men in their own community, and to figure out together if they should stay or go. The women are illiterate and living in an isolated colony in a country they are unfamiliar with, including the landscape and the language. Taves was baptized as a Mennonite at age 15 in Manitoba, Canada, and now considers herself a secular Mennonite. We began the discussion with Taves sharing how she first heard about the true events that instigated Women Talking.
I first heard about the rapes in Bolivia, in the Manitoba colony, in 2009. And that was also when the first media reports came out. I'm not entirely sure that it was The Guardian who first reported on it. But there were rumors going around in the Mennonite community here in Ontario and in Manitoba, and I'm sure all over the world, at least in North America. So I heard it then, and I was horrified, you know, like everybody else, but I wasn't particularly shocked, knowing the culture and basically, you know, that specific culture in these ultra conservative colonies. And I had many questions. I guess probably they were extensions of questions that I've had my whole life, having grown up in not a closed colony like that, not an ultra-conservative Mennonite colony, but a very conservative Mennonite community. You know, and I think in my writing for all my life, almost, maybe not at the very beginning of my career, my so-called career, because I wasn't really writing about Mennonites at the beginning. But when I started writing about Mennonites, when I started writing about my own culture and my experiences, fictionalizing them, that kind of has carried on, and so I really feel as though Women Talking is quite a natural, organic extension of that. And the questions that I had, you know, are the same, except, you know, when applied to this type of event, you know, these rapes, the reasons for why these rapes happened, why, how they could go on for so long, what was done, what was the response, was, you know, all of those things, I knew that I wanted to attempt to answer some of those questions, or at least understand some stuff. And I was enraged all over again every time I come to some kind of peace some semblance of peace with my religious fundamentalist community. I'm then enraged all over again. You know, by the things that I see and hear. And as soon as I started hearing about these rapes, that yes, I wanted somehow to write about it. I didn't know how, other than that it would be a novel, I didn't know how I would structure the novel. In the meantime, what happened is that my sister got very sick, and she was suffering from depression, and then she died in 2010. She took her own life in 2010, and that's when everything just kind of stopped in my world and shifted. And, you know, and I thought at that time, okay, well, I just didn't know what I was going to do, basically. You know, I didn't know how I was going to get out of bed in the morning, let alone write a novel, and all of my everything was gone, including my motivation. But then, you know, that's the grieving process, and the grieving, the edge came off it over time, and I realized that I wanted to and needed to write again.
You know, I think for most people, when they hear Mennonite, the first thing they think of is sort of the outfits,
of
more conservative outfits. And so maybe people don't even realize that there's a spectrum for that faith.
Yeah, absolutely. It's true. You know, people don't. So I'm a Mennonite. I wear, you know, jeans and hoodies. I also, in the community that I grew up in, there were both. I mean, my mother's generation, it was that type of dress. But when my sister and I came along, you know, that had sort of morphed into something a little bit more modern, recognizable. But then, of course, there are all the other groups of Mennonites, including these closed colonies in South America. They're in Canada and the United States. They're everywhere. They're very recognizable. I mean, the uniformity of their dress, the women in the long dresses, you know, just about every part of their body covered. The men in their overalls and hats, and they're recognizable. And they're really like tourist attractions, unfortunately. And there are all sorts of assumptions that we can make. And that was part of my goal too with this book, was to show that it is easy to just kind of say, well, these are, you know, these strange freaks in the middle of nowhere who all dress the same and think the same and, you know, have every part of their lives, you know, controlled by this sort of, you know, mysterious group of elders and these arbitrary rules, and it's almost unreal. I mean, it's such a bizarre place and group, and so unfamiliar and so closed off from that, you know, that it's easy to sort of forget that they're actually human beings. They're real people, and these are, you know, real crimes, which is how, you know, the elders of these colonies, you know, not all, but many of them, that's what they are counting on in a way. I mean, that's why they are so closed off from the world, away from the prying eyes of modern sinful society, you know, really allows them to behave with impunity. And for that reason, like I said earlier, I'm not surprised, you know, I wasn't surprised when I heard that these things had happened. And then there are Mennonites, you know, or like my mother, for instance, who, you know, lives with me here in downtown Toronto. It's very modern and, you know, educated, university educated, and you wouldn't identify her as a Mennonite if you saw her, but she is a devout Mennonite and attends a very liberal, open church here in Toronto. Yeah, there are so many different ways of being a Mennonite in the world.
So once you heard of this story in real life, and this was, you know, between 2005 and 2009, this Mennonite colony in Bolivia, the women were being raped and they were basically being anesthetized with an animal anesthetic to knock them out. And at first they didn't know if it was ghosts visiting them. They didn't know the real cause until they found out it was a group of men within their colony that was raping them. So you knew that this was going on. How did you decide to change that into the format that you did? And your book is Women Talking, and basically the plot structure is that you have one man, August Epp, who is he is taking notes. He is the only one that can read and write, and so he is attending these meetings with the women, and you have mostly two families of women, and they are meeting, deciding what they should do and talking about it, and he's writing all their notes. So that's the kind of structure of it.
I had different scenarios, different ideas that I was entertaining, but eventually it became clear that I wanted these two families, different generations of women, because it was different generations of women, different ages that had been attacked, and I wanted to represent it. And they were, you know, they were related, as all the members of these colonies are. As far as August goes, I mean, August was an essential choice for all sorts of reasons. Yes, that he's a man, therefore he knows how to read and write. The girls aren't educated in these colonies. Essentially, they're illiterate, and But also, you know, Ona, one of the women, invites August to August is and always has been in love with Ona in his way. It's not anything that's ever really overt or consummated or anything like that. But he has always loved Ona, and Ona knows this and loves August too in her way, and says, August, come with us. We're going to have these meetings in the loft. She senses that he's suffering, that he's suicidal, that he's despairing, that he's also a marginalized, disenfranchised character within the colony. He's not respected by the men. He's not considered to be a real man. And Ona, for all of these reasons and more, you know, cares deeply about August and sees that he is, in fact, that his life is in danger, and says, come with us, women, you'll be safe. Well, you're with us in the loft anyway. And so it's this act of compassion and love and concern that sees August in the loft, that brings August to the loft. So, you know, okay, here's a task. You know, she says, here's a task. You know how to read and write. You know how to write. You can write the minutes down of our meetings. She doesn't use the word minutes, of course, she says, but you can write down what we say. It'll give you something to do while you're safe with us, essentially, in the loft. And then, of course, the minutes are irrelevant. The whole point has been, you know, that August, you know, and maybe in my mind, you know, all men, but that's, but August, you know, it's time, you know, he's sitting, he's listening, he's learning, he's bearing witness. And the women are the planners, are the philosophers, and the ones who will act. And they don't need these minutes. They have far more urgent, important things to do, and will go on to write their own stories. But it was kind of in the whole process of writing, that moment when I realized, aha, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be the minute. The content of the book is going to be the minutes of these meetings, and it's going to be August. This guy with his backstory and his set of circumstances and his relationship with the women, he's going to be the one to, you know, to bear witness to their voices, to their to their actions.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I thought it was interesting because it is so much about conversation, the power people have in conversations, even the women among them and the perspectives they have. I felt like the book in many ways was just, you know, asking the reader really these big philosophical questions about God and women's rights and powerlessness versus power, and can you escape when you don't have the basic skills, like they can't read and those sorts of things. But you also have to craft it into story form. So to me, that seems like such a challenge as a writer, to distinguish each character by what they say. And I'm wondering a little bit more about your process of doing that.
So I thought, okay, there'll be 8 women. I mean, there had been 8 men arrested, 8 women, and, you know, the different generations. But really, I modeled the women after women, Mennonite women that I know, my own family and friends and mother and sister and aunts and grandmothers, et cetera. And then just attempted to, and this very, I guess this is what, you know, writers, it just attempted to take those, I mean, and maybe composite kind of personalities and characteristics from these women that I know, and kind of transpose them onto the women in the loft, the characters. And it was a challenge to try and keep their voices, on the one hand, distinct one from the other, but at the same time, not in a way. I mean, these are women. I also wanted to somehow show that, you know, these communities are collective communities. These, you know, there's a uniformity not only in the way that the women dress and the men dress, but in their shared experience, in the natural rhythm of their days, in everything that they're doing, in basically what they're being, the information that they're being given, handed down, you know, biblical and worldly and or otherwise. But you know, so of course these women are individuals, but the hope is that, you know, they will be able to see that more clearly themselves, you know, after making decisions, but that they're also, you know, a cohesive community, collective group with such shared experience. And so in a way, you know, it was important to me to sort of have their voices distinctive, but at the same time, as a chorus, you know, as one voice that, you know, would continue to be one voice to use that shared experience, that shared, wisdom, to come collectively to a decision, you know, in the way that we all do and need to do when it comes to deciding, you know, for ourselves as women, what we're going to do in terms of, you know, equality and freedom and women's rights. There's obviously an individual component, but for the most part, this book is about that idea of women coming together at the same time. And I know that there are times in the book where you kind of might think, I don't know who's saying this or who's saying that. And that didn't bother me.
When they first meet up, they're trying to figure out what they should do and square that with their faith. So that you put it out as this: 1, do nothing; 2, stay and fight; and 3, leave.
I think I personally have grappled with each of those, not because of this in same circumstances, but in my own life, in my own past in that community, wondering. I know other, you know, it's always, and I think, you know, that would extend to other people in similar communities. Should I stay? Should I attempt to, you know, can I change the way this place is? Can I ever achieve a kind of freedom or a voice in this community? Will I ever have equality? Or should I just leave? Should I, you know, is that abandonment? Or should I just accept this? This is just how it is, you know. Though to me, that seems like a kind of overall, like a broad, the questions that so many of us have, even in the workplace, you know. Well, you know, this is a good job, and I stay. Or anyway, but then there's another option that the, you know, at one point that the women quickly dismiss as being unlikely and preposterous, which is, you know, asking the men to leave. Essentially, I mean, the other ones, those were the options, and terrifying each of them. I mean, the danger inherent in each of them for these women and girls is ever present.
One of the more interesting questions the book brings up is that, you know, these women are illiterate. So how do they know exactly what the Bible says? All they've been told their life is by men, what it says.
Right.
And yet these are the men that are also violating them. So it seems like if there's a moment or a crisis of faith to be had, it could be really deep in questioning the very book that they refer everything to that they can't even read for themselves.
Absolutely, yeah, the, you know, received wisdom, so-called wisdom of the Bible, and of course interpreted by men for the benefit of men to, you know, for men to maintain power and absolute rigid control, and so the women, they, at a certain point in the book, I mean, they do, you know, come to a kind of collective, you know, sort of awareness, a realization that, oh wow, we don't need to necessarily, you know, follow this strict, you know, this adherence to what, to these rules, again, these arbitrary rules that, or not arbitrary, but rules anyway, that the men have established, because, you know, not, may not necessarily be what's in the Bible, and how would we know? And that's another thing that they would plan to do is to figure that out for themselves, or maybe not them, but maybe their children's children. and August kind of talks about this, but at the, you know, towards the end, but to almost create a new religion, you know, extrapolating from the old, but creating one that, you know, is genuinely, you know, equal, loving, tolerant, genuinely one where everybody can be safe, can think, and nothing is concluded necessarily in terms of how they will do that in the book, but certainly you know, that's what they're, sometimes the women talk about things and they wouldn't necessarily know that that is exactly what they're talking about. For instance, when August says, you know, they're, you know, using the word patriarchy or using the word commodity, but the women do know what they're talking about, and they're creating as they go the language for it. And when they have the language for what it is they're talking about, they'll be able to define and change and shape, you know, their own religion in a sense.
You know, they were also asking really big questions about their faith. You know, what would God want for them? Would God want this sort of maybe freedom for them to leave the colony and their community and go out? Was that a right place for women to be? Was God's, you know, majesty and gratitude, would it sort of extend to them if they were on the run? And I'm just wondering if these were questions maybe that somehow mirrored ones that you've had, as you maybe mentioned, or, you know, what did you get out of having these women grapple with these spiritual questions for you, if anything?
Absolutely, always. And that continues to be the questions that those women are grappling with are, in my own way, questions that I have grappled with all of my life, and I see no end to that. I had thought at some point in my life that you know, I would come to some understanding of closure, though of course closure doesn't exist, but to forge a spiritual life, to take everything that we were taught, even from the scripture, from the gospel, all of the beautiful, genuine, the loving things, the things that are rooted in compassion and in true love and true tolerance and peace and joy, all you know, the joy of belief, believing, I mean, the faith in a better world, or, you know, and in goodness, and all of those things that are part of the faith, and communal living, even taking care of one another, and to take all of that and to hold on to that and to know that that is also ours for the, you know, that we can take that and we can embody that without somehow being entrapped in that religious framework, you know, like in that culture of control, which is the church, which is the human male leaders of the churches. And in the more liberal Mennonite churches, it's not always male leaders, but in the one that I grew up in these colonies, you know, to be able to separate that Mennonite patriarchy and that hierarchy, that authority, that self-sanctioned kind of authority, and that and then to take what is good from it, is a constant weighing, measuring, you know, thinking of oneself in relation to the world. Like, is it better to be out? You know, should I go into the world? Is that my Christian, or not necessarily Christian, but is that my duty as a person who believes in something bigger than myself? You know, or should I? All those questions that are all, you could say, the baggage from an upbringing like mine, or you could say, are the questions that, again, that so many of us have in terms of just defining who we are as individuals and in community.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
Okay. I want to read from the book Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. Okay. This is a book published in 2003. Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc is a reporter, a journalist, and she spent 10 years with two families, basically, you know, all but living with them, really, for the most part, 10 years, observing, writing, and writing this book. Two families in the Bronx, and it's just, for me, it's just such a powerful, unusual book. I mean, it's nonfiction, it's reportage, but it reads like the best novel. The way that, you know, her compassionate observation of these families and of the details and of her commitment and of the time that she took is astonishing to me. And it's a book that my entire family has read and that I recommend to everybody I know. Chapter 1. Jessica lived on Tremont Avenue, on one of the poorer blocks in a very poor section of the Bronx. She dressed even to go to the store. Chance was opportunity in the ghetto, and you had to be prepared for anything. She didn't have much of a wardrobe, but she was resourceful with what she had: her sister's Lee jeans, her best friend's earrings, her mother's t-shirts and perfume. Her appearance on the streets in her neighborhood usually caused a stir. A 16-year-old Puerto Rican girl with bright hazel eyes, a huge inviting smile, and a voluptuous shape, she radiated intimacy wherever she went. You could be talking to her in the middle of the bustle of Tremont and feel as if lovers' confidences were being exchanged beneath a tent of sheets. Guys in cars offered rides. Grown men got stupid. Women pursed their lips. Boys made promises they could not keep. Jessica was good at attracting boys, but less good at holding on to them. She fell in love hard and fast. She desperately wanted to be somebody's real girlfriend, but she always ended up the other girl, the mistress, the one they saw on the down low, the girl nobody claimed. Boys called up to her window after they'd dropped off their main girls, the steady ones they referred to as wives. Jessica still had her fun, but her fun was somebody else's trouble. And for a wild girl at the dangerous age, the trouble could get big.
Do you want to say anything else? You said a lot before, but anything else about why you chose it?
I don't know. It's just a book that I read, you know, when it came out, 2003. It's inspired me along the way. I think the writing is just profound and, again, compassionate and detailed and, again, reads like the best kind of fiction.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft.
I'm going to read the first little bit of All My Puny Sorrows. And it was tricky, this first bit. I had, you know, false starts on this novel. One of the challenges was, you know, this is a book about, it's a book about my sister. It's a book about mental health. And it's a book about one sister who, the younger one, myself. It's a very autobiographical novel, you know, trying desperately to save her older sister, who very much wants to die. You know, it's about assisted suicide, I guess, if you want to think of it as, you know, the issues within the book, but essentially it's about the love and between these two sisters and what that means, what love means in this case. And the tone was very important to establish right off the bat, because it's a dark subject. You know, a book about suicide, well, that's depressing, you know. But so it was important to, just very important to me to get the tone right, to get to somehow convey the relationship between the two sisters. And because it is autobiographical, my relationship with my sister was one filled with laughter and hilarity, really, chaos, pain. But essentially, you know, for me, I mean, my sister was and always has been my muse in a way, and definitely the funniest person that I've ever known. And it was important to me that the book be funny, but also honest, and to establish a tone whereby my readers would feel safe with me, that they would be safe with me going through the story, and that they would know we'd come out, you know, we could go through this darkness together and come out together at the other end. So all of that said, it was important to get to establish that tone right off the top. And so I many false starts, like I said, and so this is, I'll read the beginning. It's an image, which I thought was a little funny, a little absurd, of a house being taken away, but also, on the back of a truck, but also, conveys that loss. Our house was taken away on the back of a truck one afternoon late in the summer of 1979. My parents and my older sister and I stood in the middle of the street and watched it disappear, a low-slung bungalow made of wood and brick and plaster, slowly making its way down First Street, past the A&W and the deluxe bowling lanes, and out onto the number 12 highway, where we eventually lost sight of it. "I can still see it," said my sister Elfrida, repeatedly, until finally she couldn't. "I can still see it. I can still see it. I can still..." "Okay, nope, it's gone," she said. "Where's it going?" I asked my father. We stood in the center of the road. The house was gone. My father made a visor with his hand to block the sun's glare. "I don't know," he said. He didn't want to know. Elfrida and my mother and I got into our car and waited for my father to join us. He stood looking at emptiness for what seemed like an eternity to me. Elfrida complained that the backs of her legs were burning up on the hot plastic seat. Finally, my mother reached over and honked the horn, only slightly, not enough to startle my father, but to make him turn and look at us.
Where do you write?
In my dining room.
And what do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
I go to the movies. I go see a lot of movies. There's this kind of great... cinema building complex just down the road, a lot of foreign films, art films, every kind of movie you can imagine. Spend a lot of time there. Spend a lot of time with my grandchildren.
And who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I show it to my partner, Eric.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Not well. I'm really curious to know what other writers say. Who does? It gets better. I mean, it gets easier after a while, I suppose. you kind of lose that piss and vinegar as you age to really fight back. But it hurts, obviously, but it's part of life. It's certainly part of the writing life, but it's part of life. I can keep that particular, pain from rejection to myself a little bit easier than I used to, and it passes a little bit faster too. You give it 48 hours of obsessing over it, and it goes away.
And what is your favorite word?
Well, I had that changes, as you can imagine, every day almost. But these days, I would have to say I'm really kind of besotted with the word recuse. I like the way it sounds, I like the way it rolls off my tongue. I like the way they use it in a sentence and what it means. I must recuse myself from this jury or from these proceedings or from this meeting. Because of a conflict of interest is the definition where you have to recuse yourself because of a potential conflict of interest. It's a good word. It sounds good. It's fun to say.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. My guest was Miriam Taves, author of Women Talking. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft, a dialogue on writing, and click like, and on Twitter at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.